Hey, good morning, everyone. Welcome back to New Term. Hope everyone's recovered from all the Yom Tovim.
Pleased to be back.
Well, I shouldn't say that. I should say I hope everyone's invigorated by all of the Yom Tovim. Spiritually invigorated, but... Okay, so we're doing the second parasha. Parasha is Noach, page 30. So just we'll... You have handouts for you. Just page 30. Just a little overview of the parasha before we begin. Parasha begins by introducing Noach, which is interesting actually, because the parasha already at the end of Bereishis told us about Noach, but introduces Noach in a bit of a different context, that he was righteous, he lived in a very challenging generation, but yet he was righteous, he had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Yafes, and so on. Then we read about the spiraling down of all the morality and the moral disaster that was taking place in the society at that time. And we read about the decision of Noah, the decision of God to destroy the world, essentially. Which follows with instructions that God gives to Noah, that he was going to bring a flood to the world and destroy the world. And he was going to save Noah and his family, and all the and samples of all the animals. And he instructs him to build a teva, to build an ark, and to protect himself from the flood. Which then follows by the story of the actual flood, how it came down. It rained 40 days and 40 nights with very vicious flows of water, and then the flood remained in the world for a year, and eventually dried up after a year. In the meantime, Noach and his family were in the teva, they were in the ark. Interesting, just before we go on with the overview, we just have the famous, I'm sure I've said this many times, but just to mention again the famous, I think it's from the Baal Shem Tov, who says that every story in the Torah is also a spiritual lesson. And of course what we learn is, we learn about the flood being the turbulent waters which we all face. And our lives is full of floods, full of waters that come gushing and rushing at us and distracting us of all different types of distractions. And we all need a teva, we all need an ark. And the thing was, the Baal Shem Tov explained that the spiritual ark comes from the word teva. Teva means an ark, but the word of teva also means, the word teva means word. A word is actually a teva. And the instructions we take from this parasha is that we have to go into the teva. We have to immerse ourselves every once in a while in words, words of prayer, words of Torah study, to build up that spiritual fortress and that spiritual protection that will protect us from all the turbulent waters which we engage in for the rest of the day and so on. That's just a spiritual meaning of the parasha, but that's, yeah, but the actual story is of course the actual flood. Then we read about Noah being instructed to leave the flood, to leave the teva, leave the ark, which then follows with a story about the rainbow. God made a promise that he would never yet again destroy the entire world. And he demonstrated that promise and that covenant by the rainbow. The rainbow is a sign of God's promise that even if people don't behave themselves, he will never again destroy the entire universe. Which incidentally, by the way, is why when you see a rainbow, there's a special bracha that you make, remembering God's promise to protect us and not to destroy the world. On the other hand, the rainbow is not considered such an amazing, I mean, it's beautiful, a rainbow, but it's not considered such an amazing sign. Because it has two parts to it. On the one hand, the rainbow is that God's promise that he will protect us. On the other hand, it's like a sign that maybe he would want to bring a flood, but he won't. Right? So, which is why there's an interesting custom that if you see a rainbow and you make a bracha, that many people have the custom of not pointing out a rainbow to someone else. Otherwise, if you see it, you make a blessing, but you don't point out a rainbow to someone else. It's an interesting, interesting custom. Sorry? They'll see it themselves, don't worry. Then we have the story of Noah and the wine. So it says that Noah started to plant trees and vineyards and so on, and he became intoxicated and inappropriately intoxicated. And story of his sons, of his son Ham, who acted immorally with him, and then Shem and Yafes came and protected him and covered him, and that was a whole story in its own. The parasha then continues with the next part of creation of the story, which is all the descendants of Noah. And we read very briefly, but it's expounded upon much more in much greater detail in the Medrash and in the commentaries, where we read about the Tower of Babel, the Tower of Babel, which was a very interesting, story. It was people who was a philosophical problem. People philosophically started to rebel against God, defy the existence of God, build this tower, so to speak, to fight against God, to rise up, all this kind of stuff, and whatever it means, because there's different interpretations. And God punished them. But what's fascinating, just to spend a minute on it, even though it's part of the overview, but I just want to spend a minute just highlighting something interesting. When God punished them, he punished them at the time they were very united, and the Chumash tells us at the time they all spoke the same language, which is the original language of the world, which is Lashon HaKodesh, the Hebrew, classical Hebrew. And what God did to punish these people were to spread them all over different countries and to make them speak different languages. So the creation of languages, the diversity of languages, was actually an outcome of the Tower of Babel, which caused, at the time, caused chaos, because people suddenly couldn't communicate with each other, and it was dismantling of their whole plan. What's fascinating about that story, just very briefly, it's not what I want to go into, but just very briefly, is this. The people before the flood sinned, and they were punished by being destroyed. A very, very tough punishment. People of the Tower of Babel were sinned, but they were punished by being spread about, and being ununited, so to speak, through speaking different languages, but their punishment was not nearly as harsh. Even though their sin on the one level was much deeper, was much greater. Because their sin was actually a idolatrous sin. It was a sin of defying the existence of God. Right? But we are taught the following. First of all, we are taught that the people of the Tower of Babel, their punishment was more in the world to come because their sin was more spiritual. See, they were very different generations. The generation before the flood had no problem with the existence of God, just wanted to have a good time, and were immoral, and were not united. They, in fact, the main transgression at the end of the day, the Chumash tells us, of why the flood came about, why the world is destroyed, was because of robbery and cheating each other and being immoral with each other, right? They were also sexually immoral and so on and so forth, but actually the main sin at the end, why the world was destroyed, was Hamas. Not Hamas as Hamas, but what the Torah calls Hamas in this week's parasha, which is robbery and treating each other badly, right? So it was a very egocentric generation, very into their own desires, their own lusts, and their own interests, and their own profit, and their own gain, their own pleasure. But they never had a central problem with God. So it was much more of a physical sin. And therefore their punishment was more physical, where the people of Tower of Babel actually were united. They were a united people. They treated each other very well, which is actually part of their protection, even though they were terrible sinners. It was part of the protection. They treated each other well, and therefore they weren't punished as harshly, but they were punished, we are told, spiritually in the world to come, because their sin was much more spiritual. I always say, it's interesting, maybe it's a harsh thing to say, but I think today we actually challenge of a society, we challenge with both together, right? In the time of the flood, there was no philosophical problem with anything. It wasn't a philosophy to be bad. It was just a temptation to be bad. In Tower of Babel, it was a philosophical, scientific issue with God, right? And today we find often that we have a combination of two, where hedonism and self-interest actually starts to become a philosophy. Which is like almost a combination of the two generations. One of the challenges of our generation, because we live in a very challenging generation in terms of spiritual challenges, right?
Do we know what a spiritual punishment is?
Well, spiritual punishment is in the world, in the life after this world, in Olam Haba, which is the world to come. I don't know what it is. What it means? But it means a spiritual discomfort or a spiritual suffering. I'm not sure exactly what it means, but it means or the prevention of being able to enjoy the spiritual pleasures of the world to come. That's also sometimes like talks about people not having a portion in Olam Haba, which means they weren't able to enjoy that experience, so to speak. Yeah. Okay, so that's the story of Tower of Babel told very briefly in the parasha. Then number 10, you see there we have actually fast moving parashas here. We talk about the next 10 generations from Noah to Abraham. Which is interesting about Bereshit and Noach. It's the two parashas of the Torah that cover the most history, right? Almost 2,000 years are covered from the beginning of the Bereshit until the end of Noach, until the birth of Abraham. Abraham was born 1948, meaning 1948 of the interesting 1948, but 1948 of the creation of the world, right? 1,948 years after the world was created. which is almost 2,000 years, and that's how Noach ends. The parasha of Noach ends with the birth of Abraham. So Bereshis deals with the 10 generations from Adam to Noach. Noach deals with the 10 generations from Noach to Abraham, and that's 20 generations, 2,000 years, boom, in two parshas. And then it all slows down very, very slowly from the birth of Abraham. Okay. And just towards the end, we learn very little about Abraham towards the end of the parasha, but we do learn about the place that the Torah says he was born, which in fact wasn't the place that he was born. I'll tell you why in a second. But we are taught that he was born in Ur Kasdim. There's no such place called Ur Kasdim. The reason that the Torah mentions Ur Kasdim is to allude to the first test that Abraham had. Right? Abraham's test was the test of the furnace, that we know that it was a time of tremendous pagan worship. The whole story of Terach and the whole story of him breaking the idols and so on and so forth, and he was thrown into the furnace by Nimrod and saved, which we'll go into in a bit more detail in a second, and that's alluded to, that's actually not explicit in the Chumash, but it's alluded to by the two words Ur Kasdim. Ur means a furnace, and that's how we know about this test, or this test is hinted in the Parsha about Abraham having this test to stick to his beliefs of monotheism, of belief in one God. Okay. Now I'm just going to share with you today. I'm going to share with you three things, really unrelated things, but three concepts of the parasha. One is just a short little interesting thing I saw, which is not a deep lesson, but it's just a very interesting halachic analysis concept. One of the stories of the flood is that. We need some sheets here. Sorry. One of the stories of the flood is that the dove, or first the raven, but then the dove, goes out, and the dove comes back with an olive leaf, an olive branch, right? And that's the way that Noah knows that the flood is coming to an end, because the water was subsiding. Now, I just saw a very interesting little thing with this. Where did this olive branch actually come from? Because the truth is, all the trees and everything were destroyed. Noah had to really start again. Where did it actually come from? So there's a medrash that says that the olive branch actually came from the Garden of Eden. It came from Gan Eden. That's where it came from. Okay. So I saw an interesting thing. You know, in the story of Hanukkah, right? In the story of Hanukkah, so the story was that there was oil that only could last one day. There was a mitzvah to kindle the menorah, the candelabra, every day in the Beis Hamikdash. And the olive oil lasted for 8 days. Now there was a great halachic analyst of a couple generations ago. In fact, he was the grandfather of Rabbi Soloveitchik, who became the head of Yeshiva University afterwards, belonging to the Brisk family, called Reb Chaim of Brisk. So Reb Chaim of Brisk has a whole halachic discussion about how the miracle of Hanukkah took place. What's the issue? The issue is that if there's a mitzvah to light the candles of the Beis HaMikdash with olive oil, which was the mitzvah, then olive oil is olive oil, not miracle oil. So he wants to know, how does it work halachically that the oil should last for 8 days? In other words, because there's always a discussion, there's two ways that could have happened. It could be that the little jugs of the little candle of the menorah emptied out and then was miraculously refilled the next morning, and that's what some people say. Reb Chaim says it's impossible that it should be like that. Because if it was emptied out and then refilled miraculously the next morning, then that's not olive oil. It might look like olive oil, it might taste olive oil, but it's not olive oil. It's miracle oil. Olive oil means oil that comes from an olive. That wasn't oil that comes from an olive. So they wouldn't be able to fulfill the mitzvah, would have defeated the whole purpose. So therefore, Reb Chaim Brisk had a whole theory that the miracle is a different miracle. The miracle was that the olive oil was still olive oil, but God changed the strength of the olive oil. So the first night, what happened was, instead of the whole thing burning up, which was normally the amount required for the menorah to light a whole night, it only burnt an eighth. So that the next morning, 7/8 were left. So it became extra strength olive oil, so to speak, right? That's the miracle. But the oil at least remained olive oil, so it was able to do the mitzvah. So there are commentaries that question of Chaim's theory. Why? Because later on in the Chumash, we learn about the Mishkan. And the Mishkan, we know, when they built the Mishkan, everyone in the desert had to donate materials and resources in order to build the tabernacle, in order to build the Mishkan. We learn at the very end, the tribe leaders, the leaders of the tribe, were actually a little bit delayed in their donations, and they thought, let everyone else contribute first, we'll come later. And at the end, they thought everything's there, and they sort of were caught a little bit without having the opportunity to donate to the Mishkan, and then realized that there were two things still missing. There were some precious stones that were needed for the breastplate of the high priest, the Kohen Gadol, and also the olive oil that God had commissioned there should be, they didn't have in the desert. There was no olive oil. So they prayed to God that Hashem should help them donate to the Mishkan, and a miracle happened. The clouds brought the olive oil for them. Right? So it says, where is it? How did it come? It came from Gan Eden. Miracle olive oil. So they question Rav Chaim's theory on Hanukkah, and they say, listen, you see from there that miracle oil is okay. Because the miracle oil was donated by the leaders of the desert. They didn't have oil in the desert. It was miracle oil from Gan Eden that came, and it was oil that was given to them, and they were able to kindle a menorah with that. So how do you say that miracle oil doesn't work? If it's got the same properties of olive oil, it should work. So I saw one of the commentaries, he says, no, from this story of this week's parasha, you can see it's not like that. It's not that the oil came from Gan Eden and was manufactured in Gan Eden miraculously. Gan Eden is a place, as we read in Bereshit. Gan Eden is a place that actually has trees. Now, we don't know where Gan Eden is. In fact, the Kabbalists said there's a physical Gan Eden, there's a spiritual Gan Eden. But there is a part of Gan Eden that actually has trees. How do we know this? Because this week's parasha, the Medrash says that the dove came back with an olive leaf. And it says, where did he get the olive leaf? Well, he got it from Gan Eden, which means he bought the actual leaf from the Garden of Eden. So there were actual olives there. There were actual olive trees there, right? So therefore, they say, based on that, we can understand the story of the desert. When it says that the leaders brought olive oil from Gan Eden, it doesn't mean the olive oil was miraculously manufactured in Gan Eden. It means the olive oil came from the olives, the actual physical olives that were in Gan Eden. They were transported miraculously. But the actual oil was natural oil. And therefore, Rav Chaim Brisker is correct. You have to have proper oil to do the menorah. Where they found in the desert, it says it was miraculous. No, the miracle was how it got there. But the fact that olive oil actually came from Gan Eden is not a miracle, because there are actually olives there, and the olives could have manufactured the olive oil. Okay, just a little interesting thing that I saw. However, there's two things I want to share with you. One is at the end of the parasha, and I'm going to go back to the whole parasha in general. Let's just go back a second to the end of the parasha, and I'll show you where to look. You got a page. Page 52. No, sorry, not 52. 50, sorry, page 50. Okay. You have a look at towards the end of the page, Pasuk Chavo, verse 26. If you look in the English, it's 51. Verse 26. Okay. And it's the part of the parasha where the parasha introduces us to the birth of Terach. Terach was Avraham Avinu's father. And it says the following. Vayechi Terach Shivim Shana. Terach lived for 70 years. Vayolad, and he gave birth to three sons. Es Avram, Es Nochar, and Es Haran. Avram, Nochar, and Haran. Those are the three sons, the two brothers of Avram, Nochar and Haran. Okay. Now it says like this. Ve'ele told us Terach. These are the children of Terach. Terach holided Avram as Nachar as Haran, which we just said. Terach gave birth to Avram, Nachar, and Haran. The Haran holided us Loit. And Haran gave birth to Loit. Remember Loit? Loit comes a little bit later in the Chumash. He was Avram Avinu's nephew. He ended up spending a bit of time with Loit, then separating from him, going to Sodom, etc. Then it says, Vayomas Haran al Pnei Terach Aviv. Haran died in the lifetime of his father. Right, but Eretz Moladotoy beUr Kastim, in the place where he was born, in Ur Kastim. Remember the Ur Kastim I just mentioned before. First of all, why do we need to know that Haran died in the time of his father? What story is this alluding to? Why is this relevant to anything? What's it got to do with Ur Kastim? So, a famous Rashi. If you look at your handout, I'm sorry, the Rashi is only in Hebrew. I'll translate as we go along. Right, the first Rashi over there. So, Pnei Terach Aviv. He died, it says he died in the lifetime of his father, but actually the wording is Pnei Terach Aviv, which means in the face of his father. It says Rashi, what does it mean? It means B'chaya Aviv, in the lifetime of his father. And then says Rashi, interesting thing. In the Medrash it says, there's an opinion, she'al yedei aviv meis, that he died because of his father. Why? Terach, by the way, I remember his father originally wasn't such a good guy. He did tshuva at the end of his life, but he wasn't such an amazing fellow. He was an idol worshipper. In fact, not only was an idol worshipper, he was an idol manufacturer. At the time, you have to understand, the culture was complete pagan worship from beginning to end. Idols, getchkas, all kinds of things, right? What happened was, we know the famous Medrash, which brought to this, the whole story of the furnace, Shekavel Terach al Avram b'noi lifnei Nimrod. Terach complained to Nimrod the king about Avram, al Shekosas et Slamov, that he had broken his idols. And the story of when Avram was a child, he discovered God, and he went into his father's idol shop and broke all the idols. So what happened? The Shlichoi leKifshon, Nimrod took Avram and threw him into the furnace. Kifshon Ha'esh. What was Haran? The Haran Yosheva Omer. Haran wasn't sure. He was on the sidelines. So he was thinking and he was saying, Belibo, he said in his heart like this, he says, Im Avram Netzeach, if Avram Avinu gets saved from this furnace, Ani Mishaloi, I join his club. That's it. I become a believer and I'll stand on my beliefs. V'im Nimrod, not so, but if Nimrod comes out on top, Ani Mishaloi, I join his team. Right? Ukshenitzel Avram, when Avram Avinu actually got saved from the furnace, Amrloi Laharon, so they asked, they went now to Haran. I guess Nimrod could see Haran was a bit ambivalent. He says to Haran, tell me Mishimi Ata, who do you belong to? Amalehem Haran, Mishal Avram Avinu, I belong to Avram Avinu's team. So what did they do? Ishluchu l'kifshon ha'esh. They threw him into the furnace. V'nishraf, and he was killed. He was not saved. V'zeh ur kastim, and that's the interpretation of ur kastim. Now, on the simple level, the reason that he wasn't saved was because miracles like that don't happen to people who are on the sidelines. A miracle happens to Avraham Avinu because he was completely believing and he would stand up for his beliefs and he was ready to risk his life. Right? To risk your life to say, because I saw a miracle happen to someone else, and it really depends if the miracle happens, I believe, the miracle doesn't happen, I won't believe, and to sit on the fence like that, it was a nice thing that he joined Avraham Avinu's team, but it wasn't deserving of a supernatural event to save him from a furnace that naturally should kill you. That's why he died. But at the end of the day, it was Terach's fault, so that's what actually means the pasuk, that he died in the face of Terach his father. I mean, he died because of Terach his father. Right? That's a simple shot, but I'll share with you a very fascinating piece from the Sochet Shavu Rebbe, which I sometimes do. There's some fascinating pieces. And he quotes an Arizal about Haran. And the Arizal, you know, one of the things that Arizal did, Arizal was a great Kabbalist, one of the things that Arizal did is he explained Gilgulim, explained reincarnations. And the Arizal was very famous for this, explaining whose soul went to whom and whose soul needed to be fixed by which tzaddik and so on. Fascinating stuff. So the Arizal says that Haran afterwards became a Gilgul of Aaron HaKohen, Aaron the high priest. So Aaron, Moshe Rabbeinu's brother, the high priest, his soul was a reincarnation of Haran. Now, if you notice, they're very similar letters. Except for the Aleph, they're identical letters. Hey Reish Nun is Haran. Hey Reish Nun is Aaron with the Aleph. So the Sochet Shavu explains, based on a Maharal of Prague and a little bit of his own interpretation, he says the following. What's unique, a very interesting thing, what's unique about Hey, Reish, and Nun? The Hey is the middle letter of single units. Hey is 5. So 1 to 9, Hey is in the middle. Nun, 50, is the middle letter of the tens. So the Aleph base goes Yud, 10, 20, 30, so until 90. So Nun is in the middle. And Resh, it's not mamish the middle, but it's kind of in the middle of the hundreds, because there's only four letters of hundreds in the Aleph base. Kuf, Resh, Shin, and Tav. So Resh and Shin are both the middle, but Resh is one of the middle ones of the hundreds, right? That's the interesting thing about Haran, about Hey Resh and Nun. Fascinating stuff. You want to say something?
No.
Okay. What is the significance of that? The Maharal explains that actually Haran was a great guy. In fact, the very fact that he was a little bit of... the fact that he was ambivalent itself was a great thing. Given the culture of the time, we have to give him some credit even for his ambivalence, right? Because the fact that Avraham Avinu was saved by the furnace didn't bring anyone else across the line. right? It did bring Haran. So the fact is, why was that? Because Haran was a unique individual. And I'm sharing with you because actually it's a very relevant thing to today. Haran was a searcher, the Maharal says. Haran searched for the truth. Meaning, Haran was a person who didn't only want to look at the exterior. He didn't want to look at the superficial part of existence. But he wanted to dig deeper and understand the inner meaning of life, which is symbolized by the middle letters. Right? The letters on the other side represent the superficial. The letter in the middle represent the core, the inner essence, the meaning, the depth of something, the depth of an object, the depth of an experience, the depth of life's experiences, and so on and so forth. So Haran was a person who looked for meaning. He looked for depth. That's why he had the letters of Hey, Resh, and Nun. It says the Sochar Tshuva, he was missing one thing. He was missing the Aleph. What's the Aleph? The Aleph is God. And we have, and I, when I saw this, it really sort of struck a chord because I think this is a thing which happens so often today. You have three kinds of people. You have people that don't look for inner meaning at all. People that are just interested in the superficiality of life, and that's one type of person. Person who just lives life incredibly superficially, materialistic, driven, the pursuit of pleasure, complete shallow and complete superficiality. That's the one type of existence that wasn't Haran. Then you have a person who looks for the inner meaning, who's searching, who looks for meaning, but discovers meaning, or thinks they discover meaning, but doesn't want God part of the picture. I think you understand what I'm saying, right? So people look for meaning, but without God. What's the problem with that? The problem with that is that the person who searches for meaning, he doesn't say that, I'm just adding this part. The person who searches for meaning without God is really, on one level, the same as the superficial person. What I mean by that is, they haven't left themselves. They're still trapped within themselves. But they understand, they're smart people, or more refined people, people who are not satisfied with just superficial pursuit, and they understand you need to find something deeper. But they'll find the depth that resonates with them, and they won't necessarily submit to something which is outside of them. You follow what I'm saying? In other words, often people talk, you know, I went, I pursued, I found this experience, I found that cult, this thing, that thing. And that talks to me because it's more spiritual. I don't want to just be physical, I want to be spiritual. And I often say, and it might be a shock to some people, that Yiddishkeit is not about being spiritual. Judaism is about being godly, not spiritual. Right? In fact, being spiritual is a very, very important part of the Jewish experience, but it's not the goal. Because being spiritual is just substituting one pursuit for another. Some people like pizza, other people like spirituality. That's a great thing to like spirituality, and it definitely represents a person who's greater. But nevertheless, it's just a different pursuit, right? But it's a pursuit, and it's a pursuit to the exclusion of other things. It's still being trapped in one type of pursuit. Judaism is not about pursuing spirituality. We use spirituality as a tool to pursue God. But God ultimately is nothing to do with physical or the spiritual. God is godly and can be discovered in every part of life, the physical and the spiritual. That's why Judaism is a Yiddish God that doesn't divorce ourselves from the physical. It encourages us to have very intense spiritual experiences, like we just had Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur and so on and so forth. But it's not a religion about leaving the physical, it's about discovering God. Going out of yourself, submitting to something higher, which when you do, you're able to realize that higher reality, God, in other words, is able to be discovered in every part of life, the physical and the spiritual. Which, by the way, I'm going to digress for a second for two reasons. Only because we never ever get to learn anything about Bereshis. And also, we talk a lot about Shabbos these days, because the Shabbos project coming up in a week and a half, and I'm giving different shiurim on Shabbos. So I'll just share with you one thought. And it's connected with Bereshis, because Bereshis is where we learn about Shabbos, and the Torah in Bereshis, we learn the paragraph about Kiddush, right? And the Kiddush paragraph, which we learn about on last week's parasha, it says, Vayevarech Elokim es Yom HaShvi, and God blessed the seventh day. And Rashi says, what did he bless the seventh day with? He blessed the seventh day with the manna that fell from heaven during the 40 years that the Jews were in the desert. Which we know, it's an interesting thing that Shabbos is the blessing of the manna. Shabbos was the one day that the manna didn't fall. But yet the blessing of the manna came from Shabbos. Which is why on Shabbos we do things to remember the manna that fell from heaven. And one of them is Lecha Mishnah, the two breads. Why do we make two breads on Friday night? The simple reason is because of the man. because what used to happen is a portion of man would fall every single day, and Friday, a double portion of man would fall. Right? And that's why on Friday night we have two chalas to represent the double portion of man that fell on Friday. That's why it's also covered with a cloth. That's one of the reasons, because the man used to fall in a way where there was a covering underneath and a covering on top, covering of dew underneath and a covering of dew on top. And therefore we also do that. We have a covering, the tablecloth on the table, and the challah cover on the top, and that's why we have the man. That's one reason. But there's a deeper reason why we have the two challahs on Friday night that the Kabbalists explain. And that, in fact, it's very specific of how we make the bracha on Friday night. There's different customs of when you hold the challahs on Friday night, how you should make the blessing. Some have a custom that the right one is held on top of the left one. Kabbalistically, actually, you're not supposed to be like that. Kabbalistically, is that you hold the two challahs together. Exactly together. In fact, some people turn them on their side and the bottom of the challahs, both bottoms of the challahs meet and they held together. Why? Because one of the reasons we have two challahs on Shabbos is because Shabbos on the one hand is the holiest day, and yet Shabbos is actually the day, and I'm not going to go into great detail, you have to come to some of the other shurim for that, but Shabbos is the day that gives us the ability to marry the two worlds of the physical and the spiritual. That's why on Shabbos, the holiest day of the week, eating is a mitzvah. It's a very strange thing. If it's such a holy day, why don't we just do what we do on Yom Kippur? Daven all day. And yet it's not that way, because Shabbos is about holiness, and it's about enjoying the holiness to the point where eating itself becomes a mitzvah, and the delicious foods are a mitzvah, the mitzvah of enjoying Shabbos. Right? Why? This lesson, because Shabbos represents the ultimate goal. Shabbos is a sneak preview of the messianic times, we are told. We will realize the ultimate goal of creation, where the physical and the spiritual are all one experience, because it's all about God. In order to do that, you have to pursue God. You have to not just pursue meaning and depth, you have to pursue God. That's the Aleph. And Haran didn't have that. He was a good guy, but he pursued meaning and depth, but he didn't pursue God. He left the Aleph out of it. At least not in a proper way. He pursued God when it was convenient, when he thought it would be convenient. And that's why his neshama, although it was a good neshama and did a lot of good things in this world, needed, as the Arizal says in his terminology, needed tikkun, and needed to be rectified. How is it rectified? And the Arizal always goes through these things of how neshamas become rectified and goes through stages. And Haran's neshama ultimately was rectified on two levels. It was rectified by the way he died, because at the end of the day, although the miracle didn't happen to him, but he died sanctifying God's name. He died for God at the end of the day. He wasn't deserving of the miracle, but on the other hand, the reverse of that is, as the Maharal points out, he died for God. He died because of belief in God. And that death actually caused a tremendous elevation of his neshama. And then ultimately, his neshama was rectified by going into Aaron the Tzaddik, who was also a person who pursued depth and spirituality, but with the Aleph. He was submitted to God. So when Aaron came along and the Aleph was added to Hei Reish and Nun, the full tikkun, the full rectification of that neshama actually took place. I just thought I'd share with you a very beautiful idea. Okay, now, I want to just talk about the general theme of the parasha. And that is an interesting thought that comes out of this parasha. The parasha is about a flood. The flood fell for 40 days and destroyed humanity. So, on the surface of it, the flood was a very negative thing. The flood was a punishment. It was a harsh punishment that was dealt to a society that was immoral and decadent. Okay? Yet, we find references in different places where the flood seems to be viewed as something positive. We need to understand how that works. Let me just share with you. First of all, in Tanakh, the flood is referred to as Mei Noach, the waters of Noach. Now, the flood wasn't the waters of Noach. Noach was protected from the flood. Right? So the Zohar points out that Noach is just not the person Noach. Noach is a symbol of tranquility. It comes to the word minucha, like Shabbos. Rest, peace. So somehow May Noach, the waters of Noach, seem to represent that the flood was actually a thing that brought purity to the world, tranquility to the world. Not always viewed just as being destruction to the world. Okay. The other thing is a fascinating medrash. That's at the bottom of your handout. We'll just learn a few lines of it. The Medrash says that Kach mitchilas briyosai shel olam, at the beginning of the creation of the world, Lehoya kelusoy shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu olam min hamayim. The praise of God, the glory of God rose from the water. Now you remember again, going back to last week's parasha. The very beginning of Bereishis tells us that at the very beginning of existence, before the world there was no existence, God brought into being an existence. But the very beginning, the genesis of this existence, was an existence, mass, matter, earth, something, all covered and immersed in water. You remember that, right? Ruach Elokim merachefes al pnei hamayim. The Spirit of God was hovering over the water. The entire universe was submerged in water. That's the way that the beginning of creation took place. God said, let there be light, and it was light. And then by on the second day, he separated between the upper waters and the lower waters. And then on the third day, he finally gathered the waters to specific locations and revealed the dry land. And from that dry land started the development of civilization on dry land as we know it. So the way the Midrash says it, at the very beginning of creation, when everything was submerged in water, water seemed to express the presence of God. Water is always associated with purity, with creation. Water is like Torah, and so on and so forth. That the praise and glory of God was expressed and manifested by the water. But then it says the Midrash that Hashem gave room. He asked the water to step aside and brought in the dry land. Right? However, it says, when the people sinned, right? So then Hashem brought back the water. In other words, he brought back and he made the world look like it was when it was first created. So he let the water again take over and the world be a place that should manifest godliness like it was in the very beginning of creation. Which seems to paint a very different picture of what the flood was. When we read the flood in Parshas Noach, it sounds like a vicious, destructive experience. When you let the Midrash describe it, it seems like an experience where the world returned to the sublime, pristine existence as it was at the very beginning of creation. So what's going on here? What is the flood? So I want to share with you, interesting, this comes from an essay of the Rebbe Lubavitcher Rebbe, and he says the following. He said, actually, this concept, we need to first highlight a very fundamental idea about Torah in general. We know that, we always talk about this, that Torah is the blueprint of the world, right? We say that the Torah preceded the world. That's what it says in the Gemara. Torah kodem ala'olam. Torah preceded the world. We've also discussed what this means. What does it mean Torah precedes the world? It means that the Torah transcends the world. And that before the world was created, there was a level of Torah that existed outside of time, because time is part of the creation, don't forget. But transcending time, Torah already existed. Which, by the way, is one of the reasons that Bereishis starts with a beis. Famous question, why does the Torah start with the letter beis, not letter aleph? And the reason is because there's layers of Torah. The Torah that we read, given to us in our language, in our terminology, in our physical language, is the same Torah, but how it's being translated into human language. What we learn is the second layer of Torah. Beyond that, above that, exists a mirror image of the Torah on a completely higher level, not in our language, in a different context. It's the Torah that preceded the world, right? We read the Torah the way it was given to people, using the language of people, using the objects that relate to the mitzvahs given to us. We read the narratives, the stories, how it happened in this world, but the Torah precedes the world. And all the halachas, that's why, you know, the mystics explain, well, we have certain mitzvahs in the Torah that will never happen. You ever realize that? There's one or two things in the Torah, like the wayward son and other things that it says that there's many halachas in the Torah that we learn and we study and we pour over the wisdom of God and study the Torah, and it has no practical relevance. Some of them never happen and never will happen. Will never happen. Why? Because Torah is not a commentary in existence. Torah is the source of it. Torah is the wisdom of God. Existence comes from Torah. Torah doesn't describe existence. Right? And therefore, there's some parts of Torah which are purely the wisdom of God being translated to us for our language, and we study it because it's the wisdom of God. It might not even have relevance. It's just God's wisdom. Okay. However, we need to take this a step further and understand that this concept, when we say Torah precedes the world, refers to the entire Torah. And not only the laws of Torah. If we say that the Torah is a whole holistic thing and something which precedes the world, just the way we learn it is how it's applied to the world, the second level, that concept must apply to every single part of the Torah, including the stories, including the narratives, which is a much harder thing to understand. Right? In other words, when we read Parshas Noach and we read about a flood, the concept of the flood must already have existed before the world was created. Okay? However, there's a huge difference between the way the Torah exists on level 1 and exists on level 2. Because the Torah on level 1 is Torah in its original purity, alone with God. And from God, nothing negative can happen. Negativity happens because God gave human being the choice. Right? So, when we read about a flood in the Torah, the concept of the flood is already there. The aspect of the flood being a destructive, punitive force is the application of the flood that happened as a result of the way people behaved. But the positive aspect of the flood was always there and was always going to happen. It happened the way it happened because of how it played out in human history. But here is the thing to understand. Because it plays out the way it plays out and it was expressed in some sort of negative form, doesn't mean that the positive aspect disappears. The positive aspect is still there. So therefore, the flood, the way it plays out in the flood, has both ideas. Has its original purity to it, which we need to understand what that is, and the punitive aspect to it as well, as that was the way it was translated into level 2 of Torah. Is that clear so far? Okay. Which is a fascinating idea. So what is the thing? So first of all, we need to understand two things about the flood. First of all, this medrash, that the flood takes us back to the origin of creation. And also, another interesting aspect that is pointed out in Hasidic philosophy and in Kabbalah, and that is that the flood fell for 40 days and 40 nights. The rain fell 40 days and 40 nights. What's the significance of number 40? Where else do we find the number 40, particularly in relation to water? We find it in the laws of a mikveh. A mikveh has to have 40 measurements of water, called 40 sa'a. So it's explained that the flood was a huge mikveh. The fact that it fell for 40 days and 40 nights, it purified, it might have punished the world, but it also purified the world like a mikveh does. Just like a mikveh that has 40 sa'a, so too the flood that fell for 40 days and 40 nights submerged the entire world in water and purified it like a mikveh does. So let's understand the mikveh, the concept of the mikveh. It's a very beautiful idea. We know that mikveh has the power to transform. Mikveh has the power to purify. In fact, generally water has that power. Water is a purifying force. We find that in Torah. Whenever we talk about purification, it's about water. But where do we find with tremendous emphasis the concept of a mikveh? Someone is impure, someone is in a particular status and needs to go through a process where that status is changed. How do you do it? It's a mikveh. How does that work? Why is a mikveh? Why is water? Why is the water such a purifying force? So the way it works is it relates back to the origin of the creation, of how the world was submerged in water at the very beginning of creation. It also goes back to the concept of a baby, a fetus, is submerged in liquid. Correct? The sack of water. In other words, being submerged in water takes a person back to the embryonic stage of creation. Why? What happens when you go into water? When a person is out of water, we breathe on our own, correct? When we're in water, we no longer breathe. Now, we come out alive because we're able to hold our breath for a certain amount of time, right? But if we overdo it, we'll drown, correct? In other words, water is in an environment where we no longer have independent life. Okay? Which is why the world originally was submerged in water. Just like fish are in water, and fish today is the one animal which is a symbol of holiness, which by the way is why we eat it on Shabbos, another shiur, another aspect of Shabbos which we didn't seem to go into. fish is one of the most important foods to eat on Shabbos, more than meat. Did you know that? Interesting. Because of this reason. Why? Because when the world was created, in the very beginning of the world, there was an interesting phenomenon. Before the world was created, there was no existence. The world got created in a physical, limited, finite existence. But at the very beginning of existence, it was apparent in the world that the world is not an independent existence, which is the truth even now, just we don't see it. Just like a fish in water. There's one animal that we have today that is clear that it's not independent. In other words, that it's completely dependent on its life source. You know that the fish has to swim in water. Take the fish out of water, it'll die. Which is why the fish is a symbol of purity, because the fish is that one animal that reminds us that there can be a being, but the being is dependent on something else. It's dependent on life force outside of that being. And if you take it away from its life source, it's gone. Right? But the rest of the world is no longer like that, because God wanted that truth concealed. So when the world was created, the purity of the world was expressed in the fact that the world was completely connected to its source, completely connected to God, and the reality that the world has no independent existence, but is totally dependent on God's creative force, was absolutely apparent. Expressed by the submergence in water. When a baby is in vitro, the baby has no independent. In fact, even physically, the Gemara says that a baby, as it's being developed in the mother's womb, eats and drinks and has a heartbeat, but totally dependent on the mother. The expression of the Gemara is, it eats from what its mother eats, it drinks from what its mother drinks, and so on. Has no independent being. When a person needs to graduate from one level to another, we're not just talking about incremental growth. When a person needs to be transformed, we know that in order to be transformed, you cannot graduate from one form of being to another unless there's a nothingness in the middle. Correct? A tree cannot be emerge from a seed unless the seed decomposes first. Why? Because if you want reality, you're trapped in that reality. In order to graduate to a completely another new reality, you have to let go of your current reality. When we're in a state of impurity, or not even in a state of impurity, when we're in a state of one level, and spiritually you want to take on a whole new level, there's only one way to do it. We have to submerge in a mikveh. You know that the laws of a mikveh is that if a person submerges in a mikveh and one hair is sticking out, the whole mikveh is invalid. You have to be completely submerged in the mikveh. Because that's the nature of transformation. If you transform, if you grow, if you take a quantum leap, but you hang onto yourself by one hair breadth, that growth doesn't take place. You can't, transformation just doesn't take place. In order for the mikveh to work, you've got to lose yourself completely. How do we lose ourselves? By submerging completely in water. When we're in water, we go back to the state of the embryonic stage. We go back to how the world was when it was completely submerged and had no independent existence, and its whole existence was dependent on God. It lost its independence and lost its independent existence. And then when you emerge from the mikveh, you can then embrace and take on a whole new level. And that's ultimately the story of the flood. The story of the flood was that the flood was always going to happen, but depending on how. It happened also in a punitive way, unfortunately. But it was always going to happen, because when God created the world, and then ultimately the purpose of the world was to give the Torah and to elevate the world to a whole new level, there was always going to be one stage where there was going to be a purification process like a mikveh. The world needed to be dipped into a mikveh. I guess if it only happened on the good stage, on the good level, it wouldn't have been destruction, it would have been just a mikveh like we got a mikveh. But it always had to happen. The concept of a flood always had to happen on some level, because there was a time for that purification. There was a time to lose ourselves, to lose its current identity, and to be purified by the water with the purity of water. Which is why the Midrash says that the water is like a glorification of God's name. It's an elevation, it's taking the world, giving the world an opportunity to completely lift to a whole new level and be ready for the giving of the Torah, which took place at Mount Sinai. And that's why the flood is actually a good thing. The flood is a mikveh, it's not just a punitive thing. The flood is called Mei Noach, the waters of Noach, because the flood, besides punishing the world, the flood purified the world. However, if Torah precedes the world, then every aspect of Torah has to precede the world. And therefore, just like the concept of the flood preceded the world, and the concept of the flood we now know in level one of Torah is a beautiful, unbelievable, tremendous concept, a purification process. But then so must be the command that comes after the flood. And the story of the flood is God said, I'll never bring a flood again. But is the flood such a good thing? So how does that translate in level one of Torah? And the way that translates, the Rebbe explains, is like this. That although the flood was an amazing thing, and the flood was a submergence into spirituality and purity and going back to the embryonic stage, but God says, okay, I purified the world, I'm not taking it back to the flood. Because now, you've got to learn to discover God as an independent being. It's no good bringing you back to that stage all the time. You've got to be out of the mikveh and still connect to God. You've got to be out of the mikveh and still discover God as a dry land person, not as losing your identity. And that's why there's the flood, but there's not bringing the flood. There's the flood, but post-flood as well. And that's just the story of Noach, but the story of Noach on level one of Torah, as opposed to how it was translated and implemented in the human history form. Okay.